Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Paleo Baby Podcast. I'm Julie Kelly, and I'm very excited today to be joined by psychiatrist and medical doctor Kelly Brogan. Kelly has an MA BS in Brain and Cognitive Science Systems Neuroscience from MIT, a doctor of medicine from Cornell University Medical College, board certified in integrative holistic medicine, and board certified in psychosomatic medicine consultation psychiatry. Welcome, Kelly. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Happy to be here.
So as I was saying before we started recording, there's a bazillion things that I want to ask you about and we could talk about that are completely and totally relevant to paleo baby, paleo moms, and health and all of these avenues, because I'm sure you can probably talk about all of these things in depth. But what I really wanted to focus on today was something that really interests me, and you've talked a lot about, and I just rewatched one of your presentations from AHS talking about depression and kind of this inflammatory model of depression. So I kind of wanted to just jump right into that, and if you could kind of maybe give the audience a little bit of idea of what that means, what does depression look like, and how is it kind of manifesting itself in people that you see in your practice today?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to talk about that. You know, I was conventionally trained. I trained at Bellevue, which is, you know, considered one of the more preeminent residencies in psychiatry. So I really, you know, sort of dyed in the wool in terms of my belief system around what causes depression, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you ask anyone on the street even, you know, what causes depression, odds are they're going to give you some, you know, hand-waving explanation that relates to the notion of serotonin imbalance or some sort of chemical imbalance, right? And the truth is that we've learned that as a culture, we've learned that from direct-to-consumer advertising from pharmaceutical companies. We're one of two countries in the entire world that permits that model of, you know, sort of industry-to-consumer contact. And it has taken hold in a powerful way. And, you know, it's not worth going into now, but right. If you sort of scratch the surface of the serotonin model or of what's called the monoamine model of depression, you really can come up pretty short in terms of science that actually supports a consistent mechanism in human beings for depression and the role, specific role of serotonin in generating depressive states. So, you know, I started to, I guess, disabuse myself of a lot of the assumptions that I had made and my mentors had handed down to me, which is that, you know, you have to take an antidepressant because it's sort of like insulin to a diabetic, and you're, you know, or putting glasses on if you're myopic, and you know, it's never going to get better and you have to take it for the rest of your life. And in fact, you know, the data in psychiatry is rife with contradictions, you know, to that, not only in establishment of short-term efficacy of these medications, but also long-term safety. And then, of course, we know and acknowledge in psychiatry, even conventional psychiatrists will acknowledge that only about a third of patients are helped by medications. And of course, you know, there's reason to believe that even that third is only helped because of something called the active placebo effect, or at least a good portion of them. So that sort of leaves us, you know, with our pants down. You know, so what is going on, and how do we possibly make sense out of the fact that one in four reproductive age women are taking a psychiatric medication?
Right, so it's boggling.
Yeah, it's ballooning. It's ballooning, and you know, a journalist who really, in many ways, changed my life, Robert Whitaker, he wrote a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic, and he maintains a very active forum called madinamerica.com for sort of disillusioned psychiatric patients. And he essentially went through the literature that, you know, suggests that if you buy into this model and you engage in long-term treatment, your outcomes are actually going to be worse than if you were never treated at all. Wow. And he's saying, you know, we have more and more prescriptions being written, but we also have more and more mental health disability in this country, and it's slated to be the number one cause of disability in the world in the near future. So what's going on? If we have more treatment, shouldn't we have less disability? That makes sense, right? That's not what's going on. So we have to start to unpack, you know, the role of medication in actually inducing long-term chronic illness around something that might otherwise have been just an episode. Mm-hmm. But then we still have to ask the question, okay, so if we're not going to reduce it to something as simple as like a chemical imbalance, then what might be going on? And that's where this idea of that a lot of us, you know, talk about, which is this idea of evolutionary mismatch. And it's very relevant to psychiatry because the chronic long-term nature of a lot of psychiatric illness, may be furthered, exacerbated, and perpetuated by medications. But the manifestation of these illnesses is also something real. You know, it's also something to consider because of how our environment, our diet, our exposure to industrial toxicants, to things that we don't even see, like electromagnetic fields, to pharmaceutical products like antibiotics and birth control and vaccines. You know, our exposure to all of these things is not something that we have evolved to accommodate or recognize on an immune level. And so that's really, it brings the realm of psychiatry into, you know, where the rest of functional medicine and the rest of integrative health is already, which is that, you know, heart disease and diabetes and cancer and autoimmunity, these are all manifestations of dysregulated inflammatory signaling and of an immune system that has been, you know, put on tilt. Mm-hmm. And so it's just applying that same model. And there's a long, you know, standing at this point literature, the first coining of the term, the cytokine theory of depression was in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so now there's just like it's a really exciting literature to follow. And it's the term for it is called psychoneuroimmunology. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it like speaks to the relationship between our gut. So as the seat of our immune system, inflammatory signaling that traffics between the gut and the brain and from systemic bodily sources to the brain itself. And then what happens in the brain? So what happens when the brain actually gets that signal? And the interesting thing is that we didn't even really know that there was any immune activity in the brain even 10 years ago. Wow. So this is all really emerging, but it turns out that there are little immune hubs in the brain and they're called microglia. And that once this signal from the system, you know, whether it's the gut or otherwise, is sent to the brain that there is a stressor, you know, a stimulus, then the brain sort of takes over and it has a whole cascade of sort of perpetuating those inflammatory signals. And we sort of know that the end product is that there are compounds that have sort of, you know, names like kynurenine, for example, or quinolinic acid, and these compounds, you know, you can even test for them, mm-hmm. That they actually start to accumulate and cause excitatory, firing in different areas of the brain, which of course can be adaptive, right, for short term, right. But it's a problem if it perpetuates long term, because then, your stress response system, which is really cortisol driven, is stress hormone driven, tries to interfere to dampen it down. And that is not a long-term adaptation either. Yeah. So you end up sort of like in this burnout phase over time, still chronically inflamed.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. You kind of took some of the words out of my mouth because as practitioners, we run an organic acids test on almost exactly. Everyone that comes in the door. And you know, we kind of are consistently seeing what you mentioned as the kind of these inflammatory markers, the kynurenate, the quinolinate.
It's like crazy words.
And
I know.
Picolinate all together, but they come with kind of a low turnover of serotonin and dopamine on the organic acids test. What would that mean to you as a practitioner if you were seeing that kind of over and over?
Yes. So essentially, you know, you can see that if patients are taking antidepressants, do a whole lot of things beyond just mess with serotonin trafficking. In fact, if I'm going to be fair and not cherry pick the literature, I should also say that antidepressants have been shown in a number of studies to have anti-inflammatory effects. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's my personal opinion that there's a better way to achieve that through right. life modification, but the truth is there, and that may be in a small subset of people for whom they are effective in a way that isn't driven by active placebo effect, maybe because of their anti-inflammatory effects. So they do a whole lot of stuff, but one of the things that they do, of course, right, is in their name. So it's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So they're keeping more serotonin in the synapse. And So that is going to be influencing the turnover. So you might see that in you know, even testing for amino acids. But what you'll see when somebody has inflammatorily driven upregulation of an enzyme called IDO, you'll see that they shift from using the amino acid tryptophan to make not only serotonin, but maybe even more importantly, melatonin, right? Mm-hmm. Which is has the antioxidant properties and also is important for circadian rhythm. So from producing that to producing these compounds that have different activity at what's called the NMDA receptor, so this excitatory activity. And so you can end up sort of skewing your use and breakdown, it's called catabolism, your breakdown of tryptophan to this other arm. And again, it's adaptive in a certain circumstance. The body really doesn't make mistakes. It's responding in a complex, you know, sophisticated way to a perceived stimulus, but it's in the chronic nature of these, you know, these different triggers that where the problem lies, you know, because it's in the literature, it's called the inflammatory response is in its psychiatric manifestations is called sickness syndrome. And that is essentially characterized by, you know, withdrawal, by loss of appetite, by loss of libido, by sort of like slowing down, you know, sort of, so where you feel less cognitively able, perhaps you withdraw socially, so as potentially not to interact with others. And this is essentially depression. I mean, you go to the DSM and it looks something a lot like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, what researchers like Charles Raison and Mays, you know, they've done a lot of work elucidating how this was at one time an adaptive response for the body to sort of heal in the face of inflammatory triggers, mm-hmm. but that now with this onslaught of inflammatory triggers from our, you know, from all of these myriad sources, it's, you know, becomes sort of like unremitting. And that's where we get into trouble.
And what about cortisol? I mean, you mentioned that a little bit, and how does that come into play? I mean, people always talk about it kind of as the bad guy, but all we ever see is low cortisol on tests. I mean, pretty much everybody that comes in the doors, their cortisol is in the toilet by the time that they get to us and they're looking for help. What does that mean to you?
So it's very complex, and I think the notion of adrenal fatigue is very alluring because it makes sense to our minds to sort of see somebody who's struggling with lethargy and brain fog and, you know, low mood and to say, okay, they're just burnt out. Their endocrine gland is like...
It seems like a gross oversimplification. Exactly. when you know what's really going on.
Yeah, it's really true, you know, and so we just have to keep chipping away at it. But, you know, those of us who sort of are trying to understand the role of inflammation in adrenal, what's called HPA, you know, sort of signaling, have tried to focus on the role of the brain. Right, so the brain is actually responsible for asking for cortisol and other endocrine outputs. So it's actually in the brain where that signal originates. And so there's some thinking that that the, you know, the hippocampus, for example, is part of the brain's like a memory center, has very rich density of cortisol receptors. And so essentially, you know, the body adapts to what it perceives, we think, to what it perceives to be a prolonged cortisol exposure by becoming less sensitive, okay? And so, you know, you can have this high state of cortisol that exists without the feedback loop, mm-hmm. and that's called glucocorticoid resistance. That is what has been best studied in the literature and best correlated with depression is this high cortisol state, actually. And so if you look at, you know, sort of, you know, through the even mainstream psychiatric literature, you'll find that a lot of it correlates with high cortisol. But there is like a little subset of subcategory of depression called atypical depression that is characterized by sort of like overeating, oversleeping, a lot of reactive sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these physical symptoms, they actually refer to them as like leaden limbs. So there's like sort of heaviness in your body. And that subcategory has actually been associated with suppressed cortisol level and output, and also more associated with this out of control inflammatory response. Okay. This is also true of postpartum depression, that postpartum depression, it looks more like the atypical model. It looks more like a flatline cortisol. It looks more like once you throw out the placenta in the garbage, you're asking the mom's brain to come back online and start to cycle, you know, in this way, the HPA axis signaling around, you know, the relationship between the brain and the adrenals. And if and when that doesn't happen, then you end up in this hypocortisolemic state. Mm. And that allows for, as best we understand, it allows for uncontrolled inflammation because cortisol is not a bad guy. Right. Part of its role is it's a natural anti-inflammatory. It's part of how we regulate our immune and inflammatory response. And so in the absence of it, you can have a more unregulated inflammatory response. And so that's one of the theories that ties together low cortisol states and inflammatory, chronic inflammatory dysregulation. But it's, you know, look, I do cortisol tests on almost all my patients as well, salivary tests. But the truth is, like, the amount of cortisol is like such a small part of the picture because it doesn't tell us anything about that signaling and about the receptor sensitivity. It doesn't tell us what the origin of the problem is, you know, if there is a problem, in terms of whether or not it's at the glandular level, which I think it rarely is, or whether it's actually at the brain level. And there are a lot of things that can induce even, you know, there are papers that implicate even sugar in hippocampal glucocorticoid resistance. So there may be a lot of things that can drive that aberrant response on the brain side of things. But I do think that's where we sort of need to focus, is more at regulating inflammation so that the brain can come back online in a normal way.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, I'm just curious, like, what are some of the ways that we can be regulating this? I mean, if people are trying to go more towards the direction of veering away from, you know, the psychiatric drugs and trying to manage these things in a more, you know, more natural and more holistic way. I mean, I know you're kind of big on some of the natural remedies for depression. But before that, I mean, what are some of the other things that are causing them that we need to take care of? One of the things we're always doing is we're trying to find these root causes. And part of it sometimes, I think, even can come from doing, like, you know, stool analysis and trying to find out if there's any kind of major bacterial infection or overgrowth and things like that. Is that one of the things that you're looking at as well?
Absolutely. So I'm super interested in the role of the gut microbiota in inflammatory signaling and specifically in influencing behavioral symptoms and brain function. You know, we know that it's a bidirectional relationship, that, you know, anxiety and psychological symptoms, even on a thought level, mm-hmm. can signal to our gut. And that's no surprise, right? Like, the last time you were really nervous about something, you might have had diarrhea, right. You know, or butterflies in your stomach. And so that direction, I think, makes intuitive sense for people. But that it can also move in the other direction is something that we're just elucidating, which is that dysbiosis or a suboptimal ecology in the gut can actually signal to the brain that it needs to be on guard, right? And that there's something going on. In the animal models of depression, they actually induce this state, like in rats, by injecting them with something called lipopolysaccharide. So it's it's a component of gram-negative bacteria, and that's literally how they cause depression in animals. So it's compelling that, you know, it may just be that if this breaches the gut-blood barrier, that may be sufficient to put the entire body on inflammatory alert and to manifest these symptoms. So that is a huge piece of it. You know, to sort of like simplify maybe, you know, like the top three things that you can regulate to sort of promote better signaling around the hypothalamic pituitary axis. I think related to that, it's certainly not going to probably be a surprise to you or any of your listeners, but is going to be the role of gluten specifically in promoting gut inflammation. So, right, like what we have observed is that, you know, based on emerging literature around this, is that, you know, sometimes, you know, up to 80%+ of people, you know, don't have gastrointestinal symptoms despite having gluten intolerance. So despite mounting an inflammatory response, and one of the places that can be a focal endpoint of this inflammatory response is the brain, of course. The skin is another, but the brain. And we know that, you know, antibodies to transglutaminase 6 are specific to the brain. We know that there's crossover and molecular mimicry with, like, GAD, so components, different components of neurologic signaling in the brain. And we know that there's also an inflammatory response mounted in almost everybody who eats gluten. And we really don't have a great understanding of why that is. Is it because of how it's been, you know, hybridized over time? Is it because it's, you know, post-desiccant spraying with glyphosate? Is it because it's processed with, you know, vegetable oils almost always? We don't have a good understanding. But one of the theories is that actually we have become deficient in bacteria, specifically bifidobacter, that play an important role in breaking gluten down, because we are not capable of breaking it down natively. But it's possible that we might have outsourced that to bacteria over recent history. You know, recent history meaning like in the past 10,000 years. And now, in the setting of, you know, let's say rampant antibiotic use or chlorination of our water or, you know, many other elements, we become deficient in bacteria that were otherwise making us more capable of digesting it. So I do think that that's a huge, huge focus for me. I tend to be very admittedly biased and absolutist about this, where I, you know, in my practice, there is not a patient who I recommend, you know, even reintroduction of gluten. It's just not a part of my practice model, period. So I think that's one. I think sort of like, you know, less, seemingly less like sexy consideration in terms of like the biochemistry is going to be, how do we promote and tone the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So a lot of my patients, and I am extremely type A and, you know, doers, and, you know, we want to check things off our list. But the truth is that there is no equivalent to cultivating a practice that tones that part of your nervous system, because the sympathetic and parasympathetic drive influence every single organ in your body, period. And, you know, there are folks out there, you know, from oncologists and beyond, who look at the role of the nervous system in cultivation of disease, you know, whether it's heart disease or cancer or autoimmunity. So it's and specifically, it's this balance and tone between the fight or flight and the relaxation nervous system. The relaxation nervous system is also critical for digestion, for triggering enzymes and stomach acid release. So, you know, if you eat lunch like I do, which is like in 4 minutes between patients, it's just not, you might as well not bother really, you know, eating healthy food, because you're not engaging this evolutionary process that is a dance, you know, like it's a complex dance. So I, you know, often recommend, when there is adrenal dysregulation, and most people would recommend this, I think, but that my patients find one, you know, appeal on a long menu, like one appealing option for starting with 5 minutes of a breathing exercise. Mm-hmm. So it can be just counting your breaths. It can be using a mantra. It can be doing a 6 count in, 6 count out. It can be doing a 4 count in, 8 count hold. You know, so there's so many different models, and there are apps, and there are, you know, websites with restricted content. I am a big, Kundalini yoga fan, so I really like the kriyas that are very specific exercises. You can even Google, you know, like, what is a kriya I do for brain fog? And it's like a, you know, 5 to 7 minute breathing exercise based on sort of ancient principles, and using yogic technology essentially to shift the state of your nervous system. And, you know, something as simple as like alternate nostril breathing or left nostril breathing. I mean, you do that for 5 minutes and your entire energetic state is different from beginning to end. There's just not much out there like that. And then there's a whole compelling literature out of the Herbert Benson Institute, you know, 4 decades of literature that show that we can promote anti-inflammatory signaling with like 20 minutes of like some stupid meditation that somebody listens to on an iPod. You know, this is not complex stuff. It doesn't have to be religion, but it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's another. And then, you know, I think the sort of final one, a big one in my practice, is the role of sugar. Again, that's not going to be any surprise to anyone probably, but sugar, because of its inflammatory signaling and what I mentioned even about, you know, its interference with hippocampal signaling, but, you know, also because of what it does to your endocrine system to have this roller coaster effect of blood sugar in the setting, particularly of a low-fat diet, which is a lot of my patients come to me. I work in Manhattan, you know, there's as much as there's a huge subculture of people interested in more progressive diets, there's still as many women who still believe that, you know, a low-fat diet is an important, you know, yeah, sort of underpinning to their lifestyle. So I think that was a long answer, but I think those are the three I would consider.
No, I think those are huge, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Cool. Yeah, you're right. It's not that surprising to us. But I wonder, I mean, I think it would be awesome if we could spend the rest of the time kind of, I would love to transition to kind of, how does this differ? How does everything we've talked about, maybe it doesn't differ that much, but with postpartum depression, I mean, you talked a little bit about the placenta, and I think that was great, you know, because we have this event, right, where we have this endocrine organ that all of a sudden it just disappears.
Yeah.
And, you know, through the late stages of pregnancy, it's been pumping out all of this cortisol, and then all of a sudden it's gone, and we have this kind of dramatic plummet of these, you know, kind of crucial hormones. How does all of this kind of come to play in terms of, you know, figuring out who gets postpartum depression and who doesn't? I mean, is it a lot to do with some of the things that you've just been talking about in terms of inflammation? Is it a completely different system? What's the difference between, you know, kind of that inflammatory model?
We don't know. We know that there are epidemiologic risk factors like, you know, history of sexual abuse, personal and family history of depression. Mm-hmm. That's like, you know, a no-brainer. If you're already somebody who responds to stressors in this way, whether it's physiological or psychological, it's going to probably be something that crops up in the postpartum window. Mm-hmm. We haven't been able to really pin it to mode of delivery, meaning like cesarean or vaginal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, researchers have been digging, like, you know, Oberlander et al. Has like done a lot of work around looking for serotonin genes, mm-hmm. and nothing's come up. You know, nobody's been able to really identify anything. So there is a literature that I find really compelling that I've been following that says that we can actually predict postpartum depression onset in the month before delivery with elevation of these inflammatory cytokines, some specific ones like interleukin-1, before delivery, and we can actually predict who might then go on to develop it. And again, it probably is, for reasons related to abnormal signaling around that HPA axis and the adrenal brain relationship in the mom postpartum that facilitates this inflammatory response in a state where she is not able to regulate it appropriately once the placenta is sort of taken out of the picture. Mm-hmm. It is undoubtedly more complex than just that,
right,
but that's at least a framework. There's also literature, for example, that suggests that that hypothyroidism and even thyroid antibodies can predict postpartum depression and are correlated, at least in one, I think, pretty interesting study with postpartum psychosis. Mm-hmm. And so that would suggest, and again, corroborate that there is a role for the immune system and dysfunctional immune signaling, or again, I call it dysfunctional, but it's really not dysfunctional. It's the immune system responding appropriately to an inappropriate exposure. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, again, we're looking at what might be some of the, you know, what puts somebody at risk for autoimmune disease, right? So the consensus so far, thanks to some of the work that like Alessio Fasano has done, for example, is that it's, you know, it's some genetics, but then it's an environmental trigger and it's intestinal permeability. So, you know, it may be something similar that you have, let's say, a woman with a gene variant, like a SNP in her glucocorticoid receptor, you know, so that's going to make it harder for her to re-regulate under stress. Mm-hmm. And then you have the trigger of, you know, delivery. And by the way, 9 months of nutrition. Right. Depletion, essentially, you know, because we don't go into pregnancy, as you well know, we don't go into pregnancy nutrient repleted. You know, we go into it with our tanks half empty, taking birth control for 12 years, which is, you know, sucking all of our antioxidants and B vitamins out with it. And then we, you know, we wing a pregnancy, and then we, you know, we wonder why we're struggling to get back on our feet. But the truth is, it's about like 10 to 15% of women who do develop, true diagnostic, like syndromal postpartum depression, because of course in psychiatry we have no actual means of diagnosing anything. It's just an impression. So it's not everyone. And probably people who have the same dietary exposures and have a traumatic, you know, birth and had a sex abuse history, there are folks who don't go on to develop it. But there also seems to be a reciprocal relationship with breastfeeding that is probably very complex, part physiologic and part psychological, where breastfeeding onset can protect against, successful breastfeeding onset can protect against depression, but then depression can also impede successful breastfeeding.
Yeah.
So it can be sort of like
it's maddening how many like 22 catch 22s there are with all this stuff. Yeah. It's just like, yeah.
Absolutely.
On and on and on.
It is. And it's, you know, and for me or anyone else to pretend like we've cracked the code, I would never pretend that. Yeah. I am so interested in, you know, where my logic is breaking down, because I'm trying to connect the dots on this. And I do think that it is thoroughly and completely insufficient to project onto the postpartum experience, which is rife, you know, with known and identified changes in physiology, let alone psychology, and to just project this generic model of chemical imbalance that we've projected on the entire population of the world who is depressed, just project that onto these new moms, I think is totally irresponsible. I mean, even, you know, I prescribed antidepressants to patients for many, many years of my career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was my specialty. My fellowship was essentially prescribing medication to pregnant and breastfeeding moms. And there are like two randomized trials in postpartum depression around the efficacy of antidepressants. So it's just like all assumptions. There's a pile of assumptions. And my concern is, and where my colleagues really get their panties in a bunch when I ever say anything like this, my concern is that these medications have a demonstrated, documented history of inducing suicidality, violence, and homicide. And you can go, you know, to websites that document all of these cases, and in the setting of newsmaking, infanticide in postpartum, you know, like the worst possible outcome, all of those women were treated.
Wow.
All of them were treated with medication. So I do believe that not only can we be missing the mark, but we could be making it worse. And you know, while telling ourselves that, oh, they just didn't take a high enough dose, or they just needed more treatment. And this is what we, you know, this is what we do all the time. We do it with vaccines too, you know, not to open that can of worms, but you know,
we have you back on to open that can of worms.
Happily, you know, but where we say, oh, okay, it's not working. Let's just add on another. So you have six boosters of pertussis before we can admit that the thing doesn't work.
Right.
You know, it's like a similar sort of psychology. We're so married to the idea that these pharmaceuticals hold promise. It's very hard for us to admit when they may actually be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's definitely difficult for people to take that step back, just to even have the conversation, let alone, I mean, not even saying, okay, you're right, it doesn't work, but just saying, maybe it doesn't work, or are we sure it works? It's just,
let's question, let's look at it with curiosity.
Right, exactly. Right. How much more, yes, I mean, do you find that you're working in your practice with women who are trying to get pregnant and trying to take more of a proactive approach? I've got this, you know, mission to kind of encourage women to take more of a proactive role in their health before they venture down the path and decide to wing a pregnancy. And I feel like it's possible. I feel like at least, you know, a lot of women are waiting longer to have kids, and why not use that time appropriately and get really, really healthy before you do decide to have kids, so that when you get there, it's not, you know, a devastatingly difficult struggle. One of my favorite questions to ask how do you do that? How do you prepare for a pregnancy? How do you kind of get out ahead of it? What are some of the things that you would recommend women can do?
Julie, Julie, you just cut out. Just say the last sentence.
Oh, I'm just going to say, what do you recommend women do to kind of get out ahead of a pregnancy and kind of work on getting themselves really, really healthy so that maybe that can, you know, stave off some of the things that we've been talking about, like depression and postpartum depression?
Absolutely. So I have the pleasure really of working with women who are motivated in advance. And often it's because they're on psychiatric meds that they want to come off of before pregnancy. So, you know, sometimes we even have a year or two to sort of optimize things before pregnancy. And the beauty of what I do now versus what I used to do is that I used to have to help women make sort of a Sophie's choice, right, around their own medication treatment versus their pregnancy in some cases, right? So, you know, we would comb the literature and see what there was in the literature to support the use of medications. And the truth is that the literature is not as scary as you might think it is. So there is reason to believe that it could be in the best interest of a pregnancy and a woman's care to continue taking Zoloft, for example. But it's my opinion that the literature is not asking the right questions, right? So it's been asking these old school questions like, are babies born with 10 fingers and 10 toes? It's not asking, are babies born, you know, with mitochondrial disorders or autoimmunity or propensity toward that or neurodevelopmental issues. I mean, there are a handful of very small studies that go out about 7 years. But that being said, you know, a lot of these patients are coming, you know, with in mind that there is a preparatory phase. And of course, all of these traditional cultures, right, get that fact, you know, they get that, you know, preconception couples should be eating nutrient-dense food. In fact, in some cultures, they even reserve food, especially for preconception women. And this notion that you have to actually prepare, not only physiologically, but psychospiritually for engaging in this phase of your life is just totally foreign to us. I mean, I took birth control for 12 years. I decided I want to get pregnant. I stopped taking birth control and I was pregnant the next month. It like makes me nauseous to think about that, you know? And I have an, you know, MTHFR mutation. So yeah. It's, you know, that's how we do it. And it's unfortunately coming round to roost because we have the sickest children that ever walked the face of the earth. Yeah. In my children's, generational cohort. So, I love when people are motivated because the truth is whatever is going to be optimal for you mm-hmm. and your health mission is going to be optimal for your pregnancy epigenetically. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, the idea of using diet, so using diet to resolve autoimmune symptoms or resolve psychiatric symptoms it's going to be the same diet that is going to support and promote a healthy gestational experience and a birth. So it's really sort of like a win-win. And I am relatively conservative with supplements, you know, yeah. in pregnancy, not for any real reason. I took plenty, but mostly because I'm sort of trained in that model of like, where's the data? And when it comes to pregnancy, we just don't have it. And what might seem like a good idea, you know, taking 200 milligrams of thiamine, we just don't totally know if we're skewing something. So if I do supplement with anything in pregnancy, I'm going to do a more broad spectrum. So if I use a fatty acid like omega-3s, which I actually rarely do, but if I do, I'll also have them taking primrose oil, phosphatidylcholine, make sure they're getting saturated fat from their diet, obviously. So it's like the whole picture. Same with B vitamins. You want them in the concert with other B vitamins, not alone. Same with amino acids. But it's sort of rarely necessary when people are eating ancestrally. And, you know, I think one of the best, just an unsolicited shout out, I think one of the best books on this is Kate Shanahan's book, Deep Nutrition, really influenced me and my thinking mm-hmm. around, you know, how we have deviated, like how we're sort of devolving as a species physiologically, like, you know, our the spacing between our eyeballs and myopia, you know, our teeth and our jaws and the need to extract wisdom teeth, you know, mm-hmm. all of these sort of metrics of how we are not, you know, we can birth babies, you know, and we're struggling with that actually too, but the actual like morphology of these humans is changing before our eyes because of not only what we're eating, but then, you know, nutrient deficiency in the setting of chemical toxicant exposures. So it's like a two hit, you know, you expose these nutrient depleted women to, you know, a range of toxicants from pesticides to endocrine disruptors, you know, in their plastic water bottle from that to their receipts. Mm-hmm. And then you prescribe them a couple antibiotics and they get a bunch of ultrasounds and, you know, they get their flu shot and Tdap vaccines and then they go into birth with, an epidural. You know, so it's, you can see how it's a cascade that we're probably overstepping our evolutionary bounds in terms of what we can expect our, you know, sort of genome to adapt to.
Right. Just even to tolerate, I think, from...
Yeah.
It's just a lot to absorb.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, this has been fascinating, and we're definitely going to have you back on because this could go directly into talking about, post-birth outcomes and breastfeeding and diets for breastfeeding women, and we don't have time for that. So... So definitely have you back on hopefully soon to talk about some of those things. We'll have to get my husband on to talk to you as well. That would be great. Where can people find out more about you and keep up with all the wonderful things that you're doing?
Cool. Well, it's been a total pleasure. Obviously, I can ramble a lot, so next time you'll have to interrupt me more because I can talk about this all day. I love it. It's just my favorite topic. So I have a blog. I'm on social media. My website is just my name. So it's kellybrokenmd.com. And I try my best to, I do these little things called snippets where it's like super short digestion of the most current literature. I probably read like upwards of 70 papers a week. And I try to just take from the new emerging science, you know, what might be of interest to people to support lifestyle-based medicine, essentially. So
that's awesome. I appreciate all of that hard work that you're doing. It's not easy to keep up with all of it. So
compulsive. It's totally compulsive.
Great. Well, I can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.